And welcome back to Success Made to Last Legends. I'm Rick Tokini. This show is presented by Heather Barnes, along with Edward Jones Financial Advisors. Man, we have got a great one on today. Kent Blazy is an American country music songwriter from Lexington, Kentucky, who now calls Nashville, Tennessee his home. Kent was inducted into the class of 2020 Nashville Songwriter Hall of Fame during the golden anniversary, plus one during the special 50 and 51st as well gala. He is a Kentucky native, and his credits include, I think, Kent, one of the greatest songs ever written, If Tomorrow Never Comes, Ain't Going Down, Getting You Home. And as a member of the Hall of Fame, we're going to get his point of view today on songwriting and hopefully mentor some of you young songwriters that are out there. Kent, it's an honor to honor you today.
Well, it's an honor to be with you, and thank you so much for making time.
You bet. Tell us about what was life like growing up in Kentucky.
Well, it's interesting. Really, the place that I was born was Woodstock, New York, before it was Woodstock, New York. And so as a young child, I would go to people's houses because it was an artistic community, and it still is. And you had the Hudson Valley Painters. You had actors coming up from New York City to be in the playhouse that was up there. So I would go to people's houses, and somebody would be working on a really big painting, or somebody would say, I just wrote a book. You want me to autograph it to you? And, you know, I'm a little kid, and I'm going, well, that sounds pretty cool. And so I think that set the tone for me that there was a possibility to do something creative with my life even back then. I thought, I don't know what they're doing, but I like what they're doing. And my dad worked at IBM and started out on the assembly line. And IBM used to mean I've been moved. So we moved to Lexington, Kentucky, and it was a total change from where I'd come from. And the best part about Kentucky is it's a very musical place, too. And I started getting into bluegrass. And one of the greatest bluegrass groups of all time was there at the time, J.D. Crowe and the New South, who had Ricky Skaggs, Tony Rice, and Jerry Douglas all in one band at one time. And I would sneak in. They would sneak me in because I was underage, but I would go hear them. And that was really like the finest musicianship that you could possibly find in that town at the time. And it was a big inspiration for me. And I was more of a rock and roll guy, but I came to appreciate everything due to that, due to the fact that bluegrass steered me into country, and I kind of mixed country and rock together and came up with what I do. And so it all kind of worked together to make me realize I could be a songwriter or a musician and make a living at it. Most people didn't think I could, but, you know, it's like nobody in Lexington, Kentucky ever said they were a songwriter. So if you try to tell people that's what you wanted to be, they're like, okay, lock this guy up. And, you know, that's all changed now thanks to, I guess, the Nashville TV show and the Bluebird Cafe and things like that have given credibility to writers. But back then, when you were 16 years old and you told somebody you wanted to make a living as a songwriter, they just, well, what's your real job? You probably heard crazy, that too, as a drummer. Well, you know, what's your real job? Well, this is my real job.
It's so true. It's so true. I love that insight. And beyond the band that you just mentioned, who were some of your other early musical influences?
My biggest influence that really got me playing guitar was Roger McGuinn from the Byrds. And all my friends were loving the Beatles, and I loved the Beatles too, but it wasn't that thing that drove me to want to play guitar like it did so many other people. It was that sound of that 12-string guitar that Roger McGuinn played, and I thought, I really like that. And so that made me want to start playing guitar. And also, I ended up joining the Columbia Record Club. You probably don't remember that, where you got 12 records free, and then the next one were like $60 a piece or something.
I actually remember that.
And your parents love that. So I joined that, and I was looking on the Birds records that I got, and I kept seeing this guy's name, B. Dillon. And I didn't know who he was, but I did some research pre-Google and found out it was Bob Dylan. So I ordered three or four of his records from the Columbia Record Club, and that totally blew my little teenage mind. And so I kind of put Bob Dylan and the Birds together as far as what was a big influence on me, the songwriting and the music and the 12-string guitar, and kind of took it from there.
What was Roger McGuinn's favorite song that he sang?
What was big hits and probably his favorite song would be two different things. Mr. Tambourine Man was the one that really got me started. But yes, I think he really liked some of the, like Dylan's The Times They Are Changing was on their first record. And, you know, that song's still relevant today. In fact, I put it on a record I did last year just because 60-year-old song that's still telling what the truth is. And I find that amazing that Bob Dylan has that capacity to do that.
Yeah, I agree. God, that song takes me back because that was one of the first songs I learned on guitar in 75. And there's a line in there, come riders, come congressmen, senators, heed to the call.
Don't stand in a doorway.
Don't block out. Exactly. That is timeless.
That was January 6th, you know, and it's like, How did he nail it like that? And then the other cool thing is he's, I don't know, 80 something years old, and he just had his first number one song with a song that was 16 minutes long. So, hey, Bob Dylan, you know.
It's fantastic. Okay, so you're coming up in the industry. Who were a couple of your mentors that you'd like to thank today?
You know, I was so lucky growing up in Kentucky. FM radio didn't get there till like the mid-70s or something. So basically what I had was AM radio. And at that time, you could hear the Four Tops and the Beatles and Frank Sinatra, Tammy Wynette, Roger Miller, all kind of different things on AM radio. And all those people were definitely mentors to me as far as what great songs were and great songs that got on the radio. And then you would do some research and find out that Roger Miller was writing all his songs or, you know, and the groups that were out in the 60s all pretty much had their own sound, like the Doors and Hendrix and the Birds and the Beatles and Buffalo Springfield. All those people got to do what they wanted to do without managers or agents or record labels saying, well, you need to be this or you need to be that. And that was a big influence on me too, that you could do a record, you could hear a record like Buffalo Springfield Again, and it was so eclectic, but every song was just so good, but it wasn't like, well, everything has to sound the same. And that was a big influence on me too, that still carries through to today. I like to shake it up a little bit.
Of course. Yeah, that's a great bridge to, you say shake it up, to talking about your latest work. Tell us about how you're shaking it up on your newest album.
Well, my one of my greatest loves is playing electric guitar. And I met this other guy, Steve Allen, at this place where I walk my dog because he told me I stole his dog. And so we got to be friends and really didn't know each other's name or anything. But a couple of years later, I found out he played guitar. And I said, well, join my band. And he immediately fit in better than anybody I'd had in any band. And so during COVID, we found out we live like 5 minutes apart from each other. So we started writing songs. And he would sit outside and I would sit inside, and then we got where we'd sit 6 feet apart, and then we would wear masks. But over the year and a half, we amassed a bunch of really cool songs. Steve was in a pop band that was very popular in the 80s called 2020. So he comes from a real rock pop background. And so between the two of us, it's really cool because we weren't trying to do any kind of genre except what we loved and what sounded good to us. We weren't worried about country radio or anything like that. We were just writing songs and having fun. And he's such a great guitar player. that I said, we need to go in and do a record with these songs because they're very eclectic too. They're all over the road, but they're kind of a nod to the 60s and 70s that influenced me so much. And John Party's bass player and drummer played on it, and they played on the last couple records with me, and they're both incredible musicians. And John was not on the road thanks to COVID, so we went in December and cut 11 songs in one day, kind of the old-fashioned way, everybody in one room rocking out and having fun. And that was my target. It's always to create music that's fun and that people want to listen to. And I was really happy with the way the record turned out.
Amazing. Okay. For all you young people that are listening, 11 in one day only comes from a lot of preparation and long songwriting. So tell them, Kent, what went into getting ready for that recording day.
The one thing that I always aim to do is practice with the band one day before we go in. And it's not that I want them to really know the songs. It's more like I want them to just have a basic idea on what we're doing. And then they put their own talents to it. I don't really ever tell anybody else what to do most of the time in the studio because they're so amazing musicians. But what I'll do is I'll make sure that I know all the songs really good. Then Steve Allen will come over and we'll rehearse the two guitar parts together. And then we'll get with the band and have a day of rehearsal with them. And then we'll go in the next day and record. And it keeps it fresh, but it also keeps it where people have a little idea of what's going on before they get there.
Sure. What do you do to prepare your throat for singing and recording 11 songs in one day?
That was a kind of a challenge this time because due to COVID and not playing out a whole bunch, I hadn't been using my voice like it had been before. So I took 2 or 3 days before really singing these songs and trying to feel what they feel like to me and what key was the right key to do them in. And, at the end of 11 songs at the end of the day, I was kind of fading, but I started with the ones that were the most rocking and then kind of cooled it down near the end just in case my voice was wearing out. So that was my biggest logic to it, was rock out hard at the beginning and then at the end, maybe just sing a little softer on some of the softer songs.
There you go. There's a person who knows his own voice and how to manage it through the course of a long day. So I love that. Hey, before we cut to commercial, will you tell us the inside story on how you met Garth Brooks and you handed him one of the greatest country western songs of all time?
Well, I'd have to say he handed it to me, but I met Garth because I had a recording studio where I did demos for myself and for other writers. And if you sing like me, you wanted the best possible singers you could get to sing your demos because it would help people sell their songs. And so I had Faith Hill and Martina McBride, Trisha Yearwood, Joe Diffie, Billy Dean, Randy Travis. None of these people could get record deals and they were singing demos for me. And so when I met Garth, he was cleaning churches and selling boots and he thought he could make more money singing demos. And he brought me over a project that he had done of 6 songs. And I said, I really like your voice. I would love to use you on some demos. And when he was leaving that day, he said, I write a little bit too. And so I figured, hey, he's cleaning churches and selling boots. What the heck, let's write a song. And so he came in a couple months later and he said, I've got this idea that I've run by 25 writers and nobody likes it. And I said, gee, thanks. And he got a little testy when I said that. And he said, well, don't you want to hear it? And I said, yeah, play me what you got. So he played me this little snippet of If Tomorrow Never Comes. And when he was done, I said, well, I love it. It's what my mother used to tell me about. Tell the people you love how you feel about them while they're still alive. And he said, what's wrong with it? And I said, well, you're killing somebody off in the first couple lines of the song. It really needs to go somewhere else. And he said, well, what would you do? And I told him and we did it. And at the end of the day, we had what we thought was a really good song. And he went up to my studio and did a guitar vocal, which Garth on a guitar is pretty magical. And we pitched it around town for a year and we pitched him around town for a year. And nobody was interested in the song and nobody was interested in him as an artist. And one night he got to sing one song at the Bluebird and he sang If Tomorrow Never Comes. and somebody from Capitol Records who'd passed on him for the third time that week heard that song and said, maybe we missed something. Why don't you come back in? And he went in and he got a record deal, and that ended up being his second single and his first number one. And just from a guy cleaning churches and selling boots, you know, that's the miracles and magic of Nashville. You never know what's going to happen.
Oh, thank you for that inside story. That's it takes collaboration.
Yes, it does.
And a little bit of timing and a little bit of luck and probably a lot of God's grace, I would suspect.
Oh, yeah.
So I love that. Hey, Kent, on the backside of the show, we're going to ask you some more philosophical questions right after this commercial break. So stand by. We'll be right back with Kent Blasey.
You got it. Thank you.
And we are back with Kent Blasey. And I want to just bridge the last portion of talking about If Tomorrow Never Comes and pay tribute to a friend of mine, David Burnett, who is counting his last days here on earth. And I want you to know, Kent, that your song, If Tomorrow Never Comes, has more meaning and significance now than ever. And the reason why we honor people on Legends is because we think that they've moved from success to significance. That is the case with the lyrics of your song and a friend of mine who's about to pass away.
Well, you know, we've had so many cards and letters and stories that people have sent us down through the years of funerals and weddings and everything else where that song has been used or how it's changed somebody's life. And, you know, it just goes to show you that everybody in Nashville passed on it for a year. But once it came out, you got the feedback from people around the world about how that song touched them. So, you know, one thing I would tell up and coming songwriters is, you know, listen to the critiques of people. But also, if you know you got something really good and you believe in it, just keep believing in that song. And if it's meant to find a place, it will.
Mm. Thank you, sir, for that. Okay. Let's talk about some other fun things. And on your newest album, For the Birds, what do you think is the best dance song of those that's on the album?
Oh, that's a good question. I think for jumping up and down and gyrating, maybe, let me think, Crossing the Rubicon is probably one, or My Wildest Dreams. But, you know, for a romantic thing, the last two ones are pretty romantic to me, Blue Green Ocean Eyes and Twilight Time. So if you wanted to get your significant other on the dance floor or in the kitchen or whatever and play one of those two, they're really good polish up your belt buckle kind of songs.
That is great. I dare you to write a song about polish up your belt buckle.
Well, I could probably do it. I'd have to get with somebody from Texas who's used to all that kind of two-step and let's go polish up our belt buckles, you know. That's a good idea.
That is great. All right. For our young songwriters, tell us a little bit about your writing process.
The main thing, and this is from about the first time that I really started writing songs, I realized that ideas come to you all the time. And if you're not making a place for them, they're going to disappear. And so I started at an early age taking little 3x5 notepads everywhere I went. And if somebody said something that I thought was a good idea for a song, or somebody was telling a story about themselves, or something hit me from a movie or a song, I would write it down in my little notebook. And then when the little notebooks got full, I would transfer them to a big notebook for every single year. And I think what that did is just made me aware of trying to catch hooks and trying to catch song ideas. And then when I would get with co-writers, I would be able to have my big book that had a bunch of ideas that I could run by other co-writers. And to me, that's mm-hmm. the most important thing when you're going into a co-writing session, is to be prepared and have some things you can show the other songwriter, and hopefully they have some things they can show you. And at the end of the writing appointment, hopefully between two great minds, you've come up with a song from either both ideas or meshing the ideas, or somebody likes the one idea better than the other. However it works, that really is the best way to do it. But I think being prepared always is the key to any time you go into a writing appointment, whether it's with yourself or other people.
Thank you for that. I want to share a story I learned from Nancy Mercer, who was the lone survivor of Johnny Mercer. And wow. She told me that when Johnny would collaborate with another artist like Hoagy Carmichael or others, he would literally, Hoagy and him would talk about the song, and then he would lay down and look up and just kind of clear his mind. And that's how he wrote Moon River, Charades, all these other songs that he wrote. Do you do something as crazy as that physically to get it in the right position, as if going to your porch where you write some great songs would be the best position to be most creative?
Yeah, I mean, I like being there, sitting there with a guitar in my hand and just not really paying attention to what I'm playing or whatever. And all of a sudden something will usually hit you. But, you know, Garth, he'll lay down. He'll lay on the floor sometimes when you're writing with him, or he'll throw tennis balls across the room onto the wall, you know, anything to just get his mind out of the normal place where we go. And, you know, I'm all for whatever works for anybody. And if that worked for Hoagy Carmichael and Johnny Mercer, I may go start laying down.
That's great. Speaking of Garth, if he were on the show with us, what three words would he say describes Kent Blazy?
You know, I think he would say a true friend. And I have to say that works both ways. I mean, we knew each other when neither one of us had much going on, and we're still friends. We still write together. You know, we love each other and we're there for each other. And that's very rare in the music business anymore, to still be in touch with people you worked with a long time ago. And these days you can write a number one song with somebody and you never hear from them again. And that's kind of mind-boggling to me, but it's just how the business has evolved in the last 10 or 15 years.
Interesting you say the business, because being down here in Austin and being in a band, I ask many people on this show, tell me the difference between Austin and Nashville. And Kent, they always say Nashville knows the business of music and Austin knows how to be a place for original country western music that works in Texas.
Yeah, and it's really weird. It's gotten a little better, but it used to be where, you know, Austin wanted nothing to do with Nashville and Nashville wanted to do nothing with Austin. And if somebody from Texas came up and had a fairly good career in Nashville, then they really weren't welcome in Texas anymore. And it was just kind of a weird thing, you know, and I think it's gotten over that. But I think Nashville is more of the business thing and the co-writing thing, where you set up a time and you come in and do it, where Austin feels like it's more free form, people getting together and just, like I did on this record, creating what they want to create and not worrying about whether it's commercial as far as what anybody else thinks. And I think that's why we have such unique music that comes out of Austin, because there is that freedom that maybe we don't have so much of that freedom in Nashville as far as what you can write, what you can say in a song. It's gotten very limited as far as the chord progressions and what's allowed to be set in a song. And to me, that is what's missing in the business right now. I look at the amazing songs that were written in the 90s. I call them pull over to the side of the road songs. And I don't hear very many of those these days on country radio. And I would love to again.
Yeah. Remember what Janis Joplin said about freedom?
Yeah. Just another word. For nothing left to lose.
Exactly. All right, three final questions left for you on this. And this might be unfair. Aside from your songs, is there a best country western song ever written? And what is it?
You know, I kind of have like my top five or whatever. Okay. You know, I would go to The Song Remembers When. I would go to Walk Away Joe. I would go to Your Cheating Heart. One of my favorite songs of all time, which is not really country, but it's Auld Lang Syne by Dan Fogelberg. It's such a wonderful story. Heart of the Matter by Don Henley. Those are some of them that still get to me every time. The other one is Everything That Glitters Is Not Gold, a Dan Seal song that Bob McDill co-wrote with him. I try to sing that song and I start crying. I'm like, why am I doing that? I don't have anything to do with rodeos, but it reaches such a deep emotion in you, even though that's not anything you've ever done. And to me, that's a phenomenal song that can do that.
Wow. All right. Well, I just reinserted my fourth question, which was, what's the last song that made you cry? So it's Everything That Glitters, Not Gold.
Right. Yeah.
That's a good one. That's a good one. Okay, here we go. Next to the last question, George Strait sings a song you're quite familiar with. There's a difference in living and living well. But what's the difference for you now?
Well, you know, to me, we're really here to create joy in every day of our lives. And to, you know, to me, when people say, well, what recommendation do you have for the music business, or especially songwriting? And I say, make it fun. You know, that's when the magic happens, when you're having fun, when you're not, it feels like you're pulling teeth or something like that, or you're trying so hard. But, you know, this world's always preaching the doom and gloom of how bad things are. And if you can find your own joy every single day, whether it's, you know, petting a dog or having a significant other that cares about you, or picking up a guitar and being able to play it, or go for a walk somewhere in a beautiful area, you know, our joy's out there for us to find every day. We just have to realize we're the ones that have to find it.
Yes, sir. Great advice. And speaking of significant, our final question is, why should people find a space in their heart for significance?
You know, you have to have something in your life that matters to you. And to me, the more you can open up your heart to everybody and everything, you're not really making it significant, but you're making it expansive. And I think that's an amazing place to come from, where, you know, your target's not to judge somebody, but to just lift them up by what you do and, you know, give them a positive word, give them a smile, something like that. To me, is the most significant thing that you can do every day to help somebody else. And in turn, it's coming back to you, you know. Giving and receiving, it's kind of the same thing.
Fantastic. Kent, you were as advertised. It was great to honor you as a legend on this show. And those key words at the end will ring through my ears for a long time. Expansive and lift people up. Wow. Tell our listeners where they can get all the music from For the Birds and all your other albums.
Yeah, they're on the one place where I always start is CD Baby, because at one time they sold hard copy and they sold downloads, but now things have changed so much. You know, Apple's a great place. They have all my stuff. Amazon has my stuff. Spotify, unfortunately, has my stuff. But I think Amazon, you can still get some hard copies, or you can, if you want an autographed one or whatever from me, you can write kentblazy.com and I will make sure you get one. And I just appreciate anybody searching me out and being interested in what I'm doing. And if anybody's going to be in Nashville this coming weekend, I have a show with my band at the Listening Room and a show at the Bluebird with my band Friday and Saturday night. So I'm really excited about that. I get to play electric guitar and play with Steve Allen. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Fantastic. Thank you again, sir. We really appreciate you being on. And folks, I think you can go to kentblazy.com, correct?
That's correct.
Excellent. And then a CD Baby also to buy it. And then if you're in Nashville, go see him with Steve Allen. Well, that'd be a treat. Thank you, Kent. We appreciate you being on. And folks, as we always say, we hope you continue to pursue success, but be significant along the way.
And have fun.
Have a great week.
All right. You too. Thanks.